Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On the Saturday before Thanksgiving, cars began arriving at a Houston Stadium food drive at 1 in the morning, long before the gates opened. 6,000 families received food. Many have never needed help before. This is happening in cities across the country. ABC News recently profiled Shauna Gray, a mom of three who takes a 90-minute one-way journey to receive free lunches and dinners for her family. She travels by foot and train. And here is a clip of Shauna talking about her experience.
Sometimes embarrassing, but it's what you have to go through.
Is there a night that you and your husband go without food just to make sure the kids have food?
Most of the time. We will make sure that they have had their portion and maybe another portion before we would eat. And me and Dad have kind of gotten to the point of now that we only eat maybe once a day. All right, y'all. Let's set ourselves down.
Meet the Gray family. Three kids with special needs. Dad, a dishwasher. And Shauna, a server.
So just to get a little bit of food is a hard deal nowadays.
Both of them lost their jobs when restaurants were forced to close.
Some milk this morning.
Entering their apartment is humbling.
Shauna, what is the hardest part of your day at this point?
When you hear your daughter say to you, Mommy, can we move? Because this place just got too many bugs. Oh, Mommy, I'm tired of the mice running across my feet when I go to the bathroom. I don't want to get up and go to the bathroom. My son started peeing on himself. We had got worked so hard to get him to go to the bathroom, which is a task when you have a child that's nonverbal. He goes to the bathroom, but at night he will pee his bed because he's scared that something's going to run across his feet.
And thanks to ABC News for that clip. That is Shauna Gray, a mom of three, talking about what she's going through, her struggles today, and so many others are in similar situations. Nearly 26 million people in the U.S. say they don't have enough food to eat. That is one in eight households. One in six have children. In that clip, we learn that in Washington, D.C., over 200,000 kids are going hungry. That is a 60% increase over the past few months. Families of color are disproportionately affected. Advocates say the short-term solutions are so obvious. People need unemployment relief, a monthly stipend to help them make ends meet, and increased SNAP benefits. House Democrats passed a bill months ago, but Republicans pushed for a smaller relief package with COVID immunity for corporations, and that is a major sticking point. Most pandemic programs are expiring later this month, so if Congress does not act, more than 12 million people will lose unemployment benefits. And just to give you an update on where we are right now, a bipartisan group of centrist senators introduced a $908 billion plan yesterday, and that would extend unemployment insurance by $300 a week for 18 weeks and provide cash to small businesses. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants a much smaller bill, a $500 billion proposal that Senate Democrats have already blocked twice this year. And McConnell's bill does not include eviction protections for renters or any assistance for small landlords, according to reports. So joining us to talk about where we are today is Raj Patel, an award-winning author, filmmaker, and research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Raj is the author of Stuffed and Starved and co-author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. Raj has testified about the causes of the global food crisis and is a member of the International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems. He is co-host of the food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Hi, Raj. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to hear your voice, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you as always, Raj. It's been too long. You know, when we were putting this show together, I was thinking about this documentary we featured called A Place at the Table. And it focused on young children who go hungry on a regular basis. And I was thinking, when did this come out? 2012, eight years ago. So, you know, none of this is new. It's just gotten worse because of COVID.
That's absolutely right. And thank you for remembering that hunger in the United States has a long history, and that in large part, it doesn't tend to feature in the news, even if, America has had food insecurity rates wobbling at about 13%. And during the Great Recession, it hit 16%. So 50 million Americans at the height of the Great Recession went hungry. And last year it was nearer 35 million. And people seem to be okay with that. And that's horrific just by itself. And, I'm always struck by, for example, students that I work with will often say, sometimes you have to skip a meal because that's just part of the grind of being a student. And that kind of food insecurity has become normalized in the United States in ways that other countries find that, frankly, appalling. And now, of course, in the United States, because, as you've so precisely reported, that the Republican Senate seems unlikely to actually pay people to stay at home and to stay safe, the levels of hunger are skyrocketing once again.
And so this is nothing new. The one thing that strikes me, Raj, when I watch these TV clips, because of course this is getting so much attention because the demand is just so high. And the Washington Post had a piece last week that really stops you in your tracks because it includes drone footage of a Houston Stadium food drive. So you see just lines of cars hour after hour. But what these pieces hardly ever talk about is the systemic changes that are needed. And of course, yes, it's great that the communities are coming together, that the food banks are coming together, but this is not sustainable.
Well, you're right, Rose. Just listening to the clip that you played from ABC just there, the Gray family, if I heard right, the father washes dishes in a restaurant and the mother is a server. It's no accident that those professions are the most exposed to food insecurity. I mean, in the United States, 7 out of the 10 worst paying jobs in this country are in the food system. Let's dwell on that irony for a second, that the people whose job it is to serve and prepare food and to clean up afterwards are the very people who are least able to be able to afford that food. And that's true from the field all the way to, the cleaning up the dishes afterwards. And those systemic issues are baked in, not just into the sort of fabric of the way the food industry works in the United States, but baked into the history of this country. This country was founded on the exploitation of land, of indigenous people, and of then the subsequent enslavement of people from Africa to work in the food system. And one of the reasons why we see low pay all the way along the food system is because that history is still very much alive.
Exactly. And you have senators like Bernie Sanders coming out with reports on a pretty regular basis. The Government Accountability Office recently released a study at the behest of Senator Sanders, looking at the top 4 employers of SNAP and Medicaid beneficiaries in every state. And McDonald's is always in the top 5. So, and then Walmart is right up there too. So you've got so many working people who are on benefits because they just cannot make ends meet.
And, the worst of it is that during this pandemic, those inequalities have been accentuated. I mean, I think we can all recognize that at the beginning of, the pandemic, there were lots of advertisements on television saying, thank you, essential workers, you're heroes. But in very few cases did that translate into anything like pay. Even when it did, like Kroger, for example, had hero pay. But since our concern for the working class has faded somewhat, Kroger has canceled its hero pay, according to a recent report from the Brookings Institution, and instead has reauthorized the purchase of stock to the tune of $1 billion. And you're seeing through COVID, the rich getting substantially richer and the working class being left for dead.
And it's important to note that the minimum wage has not moved at all for 10 years. At the federal level, it is still $7.25, and it has fallen well below the amount it used to be when adjusted for inflation. So $7.25 at the federal level, and as you said, Raj, talking about food workers, they make far less in many cases.
Right. And then, of course, you know, there are states where there's still a lower than federal minimum wage level for tipped work, for example. And tipping, of course, you know, is another of these vestiges of the U.S., the enslavement of people in the U.S. agricultural history. And then through Reconstruction, tipping was a way of making white supremacy operable. So the idea of the tip was precisely a kind of racial schooling. And that's still very much alive and well. And so, we do see, particularly in the food system, these kinds of historical vestiges that I know the right's been having a field day talking about why colonialism is just dead and buried, but it's alive and well. And so is the sort of ongoing legacies of the history of slavery in the United States. And you can see that in the food system more clearly than anywhere else.
Well, and when we look at the relief package, studies have shown that so many people did not fall into poverty because of the first relief package, and that additional unemployment at least helped people make ends meet. They were still struggling, but at least it helped them. They did not have to go to bed every night wondering if they were going to lose their home or not eat. And it's really shocking to think that, and really, to be honest about this, Republicans have held up this bill. Are there problems with the Democratic bill? Yes. Yesterday, we just learned that most of the PPE money went to corporations. So we can definitely criticize that. But when we're talking about relief that needs to go to individuals, the bill helped people. The Democrats wanted to extend it, and the Republicans stopped it. And for 6 months, people have had very, very little relief.
And as you mentioned at the top of the hour as well, I mean, you know, there is a very thinly veiled racial dimension to this. For example, if you strip out eviction protections, who is it that's most going to be hurt? It's going to be low-income communities, disproportionately people of color. And when you remember that one in five black women in the United States in her life will face an eviction, and when you remember that, you know, COVID is going to make that all the more acute, and when you remember that, these patterns of skipping meals in order to help your children eat is something that's so widespread that in one survey, 40% of American households reported that was the case. And, you know, if that number is true, and I'm not yet convinced of the methodology, but that means 130 million people in this country are touched by food insecurity. Then, you know, the ostensible frugality and austerity of the Republican, hold up is unveiled for what it is, which is demonstrable cruelty. And the cruelty, as many have said, is the point.
And again, just to give people an update here, we're hearing that some sort of bill could be, it has to be, something has to pass, because people will be in even more dire straits if the eviction protections expire and if there's no more unemployment. And we should say there are eviction protections for some people, but the courts are still operating on Zoom. I heard a woman out of Texas, which is where you are, on NPR this morning, saying that it's just been brutal. People are being evicted right now over Zoom.
Yeah, and of course, that I think it is important to join the dots here between what SNAP, for example, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, can do for folk, but also the web of other things that people need in order to be able to stay safe with their families, to look after their children, and not to expose their children or themselves to the pandemic, and all of these require federal spending. And as you say, at the beginning of the pandemic, what the government showed was possible is that you can do this. The government can print the money, can take on the debt in order to keep people safe. It boggles the imagination that the Senate would not repeat that out of sense of compassion. But then you have to remember that in fact, without, as Rand Paul suggested, the sort of motivating hunger to be able to get back into the workplace, folk are going to struggle. There is an ideological reason behind the suffering of poor people in the United States, and the Republican Senate seems very bought into continuing that. Mm.
Raj Patel is an award-winning author, filmmaker, co-host of the Food Politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. If you have any questions for Raj about hunger, if you have any stories to share, just any thoughts really about where we are right now as we head into December. It's December 2nd. Congress only has a couple of weeks to get its act together and for Republicans to agree to some kind of bill. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Raj, let's talk about short-term changes, and then we can talk about longer-term changes. When you think about benefits, this word is thrown out a lot. I mean, you have people, you know, saying, well, people get free stuff and I don't want to pay for it. I heard that from people who voted for Trump. But when you talk about these benefits, they're actually very small. I mean, when you think about SNAP benefits, think about how much it costs today to go to the grocery store. Things have gone up drastically. It's very expensive. In many cases, we're talking about $3 a meal here with SNAP benefits.
Right. And yeah, I mean, you know how far that goes in the Bay Area. For most people, SNAP benefits run out before the middle, and certainly by the end of the month, those benefits don't last. And so you see the kinds of phenomena in U.S. families that, for example, you see in families in sub-Saharan Africa, where parents will, as the Gray family you reported earlier on showed, that they'll skip meals in order for their kids to eat. But of course, you know, kids will also skip meals because kids aren't foolish. They can see that their parents, gently just sort of passing over a plate. And kids will also adopt strategies in order that their parents can eat. And that sort of combined tragedy is one that you can see actually in sub-Saharan Africa, but you can see it in the United States. And again, the tragedy is that other countries have managed to keep wage rates up. I mean, under the Conservatives in the United Kingdom, where you have seen more and more people turning up to food banks, there was for a very long time a commitment to keep people at 70% of salary. And in those cases, an ideologically conservative government was persuaded to do the right thing by a coalition of forces that said, look, there's no other way to survive this crisis, but to do something other than protect the workers who will need to get out of this crisis. So, for the Republicans to be holding up just the meager benefits in the way that they are is also self-defeating, because what we're doing is storing up much more trouble in terms of trauma and in terms of eviction and then rehousing and the costs of moving and helping people relocate and helping people get back into the economy that we could avoid through a generous and supportive stimulus package.
Exactly. And also, this is probably for another conversation, but I would like to get your take on this. Because it's so difficult to make ends meet, people tend to turn to cheap food, which is unhealthy. And in the long term, that causes major health problems.
That's right. It is certainly a much deeper conversation that we need to have about how it is that our food has become a toxic part of our environment, and that if we are serious about treating ourselves and our planet, then we have to reduce that systemic quality of our interaction with the world around us. And I'm working on a project with Bay Area doctor and star Rupa Maria on this, and I'm looking forward to sharing the fruits of that next year.
Oh, well, we'd love to have you both on to talk about that. You know, we talked about wages also, Raj, and Florida got a lot of attention because Joe Biden did not win Florida. So many Democrats lost their races in Florida, and yet Florida voters approved a $15 minimum wage by over 60%. It got over 60% of the vote. What's mm-hmm. not getting attention is that this is not going into effect until the year 2026.
Right.
Right? Because it's a dollar here, a dollar there. And this happens pretty regularly. I was kind of surprised. I thought, oh, this is going to affect in January. Oh, no, it's 2026.
Right. That's the peril here is that in many ways, there are already carve outs for people who are most vulnerable. So, for example, in terms of minimum tip wages or in terms of workers in agriculture who are prohibited from unionizing and whose work doesn't fall under the ambit of these kinds of state minimum wage regulations. So if you're looking at you know, the folk most exposed to hunger, $15, you know, 6 years from now, 5 years from now, is scant help. And for people who are not even eligible for that, of course, you know, the crisis is now. And that's why we do need concerted federal action. And that's why there is, at the moment, a fairly bitter fight being waged behind the scenes around the appointment of the next Secretary of Agriculture in the Biden administration, because quite a lot rests on who that person is and whether they are a sort of continuation of the Obama era, Tom Vilsack sort of propping up of agricultural monopolies, which most rural Americans find very distasteful, or whether it's an approach that might actually recognize that, first of all, you know, when you think of the farm bill, you think of farms, but actually the biggest part of the farm bill is food assistance, you know, the SNAP program. And if someone is able to recognize that actually what the Department of Agriculture needs to turn into is much more of a sort of Department of Food, something that is able to sustain rural America in ways that grow food that's affordable for everyone, and a way to make sure that everyone gets to eat well, that kind of person at the head of the USDA is going to be a real ally in the war on poverty and hunger. But that's why there is such a bitter fight at the moment between the sort of neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party, who's pushing someone like Heidi Heitkamp, and the more progressive wing that's pushing someone like Marcia Fudge.
Well, let's talk briefly about both of them. Mother Jones has a piece about Heidi Heitkamp by Tom Philpott. He reports that Heitkamp is tightly allied with her state's massive oil and coal interests and has consistently opposed action to cut greenhouse gas emissions. After she lost her Senate seat in the 2018 midterms, she launched the One Country Project, which is a group that tries to help the Democratic Party engage rural voters. He reports that her politics are so non-threatening to agribusiness interests that when Trump was forming his cabinet after the election, he temporarily placed her at the top of the shortlist for the USDA, but he ultimately settled for the pro-agribusiness Sonny Perdue, a Republican former governor of Georgia.
Yes, no, I learned about that from Tom Philpott is my co-host of The Secret Ingredient. And, we've been talking to people like Naveena Khanna, for example, the co-founder and director of the HEAL Food Alliance. And she was also pointing out that Heitkamp was so far right, she was on Trump's list. And I think that's what's interesting is the kind of reaching across the aisle moment that she represents herself as being capable of. Utterly fails rural America. When you talk to friends, for example, in farms in Wisconsin, and I have friends in farms in Wisconsin, like Jim Goodman, the head of the National Family Farm Coalition, we're in touch a great deal, and he's saying, look, actually, the issue that matters to quite a lot of people around me, says Jim, is monopolies. People don't like the unfairness that comes with agricultural monopolies and the consolidation that we're seeing in the agricultural sector. And the Democrats have been responsible for that and pushing that for decades. One of the great disappointments of the Obama administration is that they failed to dismantle these agricultural monopolies and, in fact, oversaw consolidation. And what Trump has done is be able to perform a kind of protection of America's heartland, essentially by giving away large, huge gobs of money to farmers in exchange for undertaking this trade war with China, under the guise of fairness. Now, someone who is interested in fairness would surely recognize the importance of breaking up agricultural monopolies. But in fact, what we've seen under the Democrats largely is a consolidation process, not just in sort of the monopolies of meat, for example, or of grain production, but across the board. So if we're serious about someone taking that on, then surely you don't want someone to reach across the aisle and endorse monopolies. You want someone to break them up.
You know, Raj, before we go to break, we'd love to have you back to really connect this to the globe, because with globalization, so much of this is connected. So much of the food we buy is now from countries overseas. And I was listening to a talk yesterday with people who run the organization A Growing Culture. Mm-hmm. And Lauren Cardelli is the founder of A Growing Culture. He's currently in Africa, and forgive me, but I do not remember where exactly he is. He said that what's happening under COVID is that there's a major land grab happening, that so many farmers who do not own their land are losing their land to agribusiness.
Well, that's right. That's one of the other disappointments of the Biden administration sort of unity document that that was brokered between the Biden and Sanders camps was that what you saw in terms of U.S. trade relations was a kind of return to business as usual, where large agricultural monopolies and large investment concerns would bring the magic of American large-scale agriculture to the global South. And so you are seeing these land grabs happening fairly systematically across the continent, but you're also seeing other things. I mean, it's important not just to represent Africa as a place of abandon. I do work with colleagues in Malawi, a country of 17 million, and the number of COVID cases the other day was 2. We ought not to succumb to Afro-pessimism, but at the same time acknowledge that, U.S. imperial capital is out there, and so is European capital, to be fair, and so is Chinese capital, and so is capital from the Middle East. And all of them are interested in the land and the water that goes with it. At the same time, there have been incredible movements of public health and preservation that have actually helped people survive this catastrophe.
Mm. Raj Patel is an award-winning author, filmmaker, and co-host of the Food Politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Today, we are talking about the hunger crisis in the United States. Nearly 26 million people say they often don't have enough food to eat. Food banks are struggling to keep up with demand. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the growing hunger crisis in this country and what needs to happen with the relief bill as soon as possible, and then longer-term systemic changes. We're joined by Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved, co-author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, and co-host of the Food Politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Now I would like to welcome Andy Fisher to the show. Andy is executive director of EcoFarm and author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Hi, Andy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you, Andy. I just want to ask you, since you wrote a whole book about food banks, what really stands out for you in terms of what we're seeing here? We talked about how the Saturday before Thanksgiving, cars began arriving at a Houston Stadium food drive at 1 in the morning, obviously long before the gates opened, and we're just seeing this across the country.
I mean, I think what stands out for me, a couple of things. One is just the levels of need and desperation in the country, where you see exactly that kind of scene replicated around the country. And you see, persistent levels of high unemployment. And even that need isn't reflected. The need is reflected even beyond those levels of unemployment and people who aren't working full time. People who are food insecure, despite perhaps having some part-time jobs. And I think the other part of it is the extent to which the media has zeroed in on food banks as the solution to this hunger crisis.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, there hasn't been in article after article within the media, and even at the philanthropic level, what you see is just a reinforcement of the same old strategies. Mm-hmm. Food banks have been around for 40 years. They have not solved the hunger problem in the United States. Food insecurity has essentially remained stagnant from 1995 until 2019, with slight dips in 2019. But in general, we're not solving the problem that way. And as Raj mentioned, and you mentioned before, we need to raise wages. We need to raise them quicker than we have been doing. We need to increase SNAP benefits. But you don't see a focus on those kind of political strategies. You see a focus on the apolitical things that we can do through charity instead. And the media isn't, from what I'm seeing, the media really isn't portraying those efforts, and philanthropists aren't investing enough into those kind of structural issues as they are into just the media band-aid kind of solutions, such as food banking.
Yeah, I mentioned to Raj, I was watching a number of TV clips about this last night, and it's always framed as, this is so horrible, but it's amazing that the community's coming together and around the holidays, especially, we're there for each other, which, of course, yes, that is heartwarming, but it has to go beyond that.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel exactly the same way that, you know, I'm, you know, given the lack of communal responsibility the Republicans have shown around, for example, mass and even just denying that there's a role for the government in addressing the public, the safety of the public around COVID. Nonetheless, you see charity as this bipartisan strategy that I call the lowest common denominator in American politics. Everybody agrees that nobody should go hungry in this country. And the way to arrive at that, you know, universally is acknowledged as charity. Whereas we all know that, that's not going to case. You can't food bank your way out of hunger. And food bankers will be the first ones to tell you that, that they need higher wages, they need more SNAP benefits. We need a different set of politics in this country that, that goes beyond that consensus around charity.
Tell us more about what you mean by the hunger industrial complex, the web of connected corporations, anti-hunger groups, and government agencies that perpetuate hunger because it is profitable.
Sure. Maybe the best way to do this is to give you an example. And the example I like to use is Walmart, because it's so salient and it's so obvious. So Walmart is well known for paying its employees poor wages. $11 or $12 an hour now, I think, is the starting wage. This is higher than the minimum wage in many states. But Walmart doesn't like to give its employees full-time hours, because then they would have to pay them benefits. So then Walmart actively encourages its employees to go on to go to food banks. It actively encourages them to use SNAP benefits or food stamp benefits. And I've done some math and found that we're subsidizing Walmart as taxpayers over $600 million a year to pay its workers low wages. The Walmart then goes one step further. It donates hundreds of millions of dollars of cash and food to food banks around the country. It gets lots of earned media. You know, every time they make those donations, they get a little press blurb that actually bolsters their stock price. It bolsters their reputation. It portrays them as being a hunger fighter instead of a hunger causer. It recasts their reputation, which has a lot of value even on Wall Street these days. And then Walmart is also the single largest redeemer of SNAP, with about $70 to $80 billion going through the SNAP program every year. Walmart redeems about $1 in every $5 or $1 in every $6 of that. So it's double, triple, and quadruple dipping through this process. So that's what I mean by the hunger industrial complex. It's that corporations, businesses, and the government are all in it together, just as the military industrial complex, as Eisenhower spoke about. It's a way to keep hunger going because it's profitable for everybody. Food banks continue to exist. They continue to grow. Their CEOs, in many cases, make $300,000, $400,000 a year. Corporations get tax breaks from their donations. They get positive media. They get to whitewash their egregious labor practices. And the government gets to fund food banks giving them essentially chump change while saving money on larger programs such as the SNAP program.
I didn't realize it, but you write in one of your recent pieces, even the mean-spirited Trump administration has poured at least $10 billion into food banks since 2017.
Exactly. So I think what people don't recognize is that the emergency food system or the food banking system is not just a private enterprise. It's not just a private sector effort. It's really a public-private effort. It's really public-private enterprise. And so what I mean by that is that roughly prior to the pandemic, about one-fifth of the food that came through food banks was government commodities. So the USDA buys food from farmers, from food company, from food manufacturers, products that whose prices was dipping. So they bolster the prices through buying these commodities. They process them. They have them processed, and they give them to schools, and they give them to food banks. So what the government has been doing, that's called the TFAP program. That program has been going on since the 80s. What Trump has done has been two things in additional, as I think you referred to a little bit before, Raj referred to. They've bought billions of dollars of what's called tariff mitigation foods, the foods from farmers whose trade was affected by the tariffs with China. So they've bought billions of dollars of food from these farmers, distributed those to food banks as a way to curry favor in the rural community, essentially to buy off those farmers' votes. And then more recently with the pandemic, they've invested billions of dollars into the Farms to Family food box program, which is purchasing, which is paying food distributors, food hubs, and food processors to assemble boxes of produce, dairy, and meat for distribution directly to low-income folks through food banks and through other food charities. So altogether, those efforts are about $10 billion, which is a dramatic increase from previous administrations.
Raj, can you jump in here? What would you add when we're talking about this hunger industrial complex, and how does society take this on?
I always learn from Andy, and I would add a couple of things. I mean, again, the contours of power here replicate the long histories of racism that we see in the United States. And so insofar as the USDA remains an institution that's lost one of the largest racial discrimination suits in the history of the United States, it continues to do badly by Black people in the United States. And there was an article yesterday on Civil Eats about how many Black farmers were saying that they've been left out of this new food box program. And there seems to be something of a systematic pattern to that. I think the way to fight back is to follow, the example of one of the great Bay Area sort of legendary responders to hunger, which is the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers also ran something of a food bank, and they had free breakfast programs and what have you. But the way that they met the dignified emergency among the poor was not merely to just engage in charitable acts, but to engage in a broad spectrum of survival programs pending revolution. And so the spread of survival programs range from food to healthcare to work to shoes and housing. And I think you do need a combined, an integrated approach to recognize that hunger is one, is something that has many dimensions and many facets. And you can't solve hunger with merely increasing SNAP. You can't put you can't have food banks who should be putting themselves out of business. I mean, that should be the job of a food bank. But you can't delegate to food banks that duty because, as Andy says, they're not in that game. So you do need broader political transformation. And what's been very interesting in the protests around police violence and in the movement for Black Lives and in the subsequent kind of articulations from calls for racial justice to ideas about reparations for colonialism in the Red Deal, for instance, is that there are lots of very well theorized and really broad approaches to understanding that hunger is something that has to be tackled right now, but it's something that needs systemic change, that needs organizing. And what's very heartening about the protests that we saw in 2020 and which we continue to see in 2020 is that they are protests that understand that in order to solve hunger, you don't merely raise wages and increase SNAP benefits, but you do need to seize power.
Right. And in the near term, of course, the wages need to be raised and the SNAP benefits need to be raised. But that is the other element of it, Raj. And Andy, when we're talking about near-term solutions, even long-term solutions, I mean, in your book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups, you call out some of these large food banks for not embracing a $15 minimum wage, for not embracing some of these progressive policies. And in the latest piece that you wrote, you point out that the nation's second largest charity, Feeding America, has a $2.8 billion budget. It deploys a network of 200 food banks across the country and feeds 40 million people. What are you calling for in this latest piece? You say that you really want food banks to step it up and talk about some of these major policy changes that are needed.
Yeah, I mean, we've been acting as if we've been in the meantime for 40 years. And what I mean by that is, we've been doing food banks for 40 years and it hasn't solved the problem. Mm-hmm. Food insecurity has become entrenched in this country. It's become this persistent problem. And in the meantime, we've seen the real value of wages decline. We've seen greater income inequality. We've seen greater wealth inequality between the rich and the poor in this country. And a lot of that has to do with macroeconomic issues. It has to do with the structure of who's working and where they're working and what they're getting paid, as well as declines in the value of government social safety programs, such as the SNAP program and welfare reform. So you see this incredible transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich over the past 40 years. And the response that I get from food bankers is that, you know, we need to do this, as Raj said, and kind of as a survival program. We need to do this because people are poor, and we're doing this in the meantime until we can get to a better administration or a better set of policies. So that meantime hasn't come. And the question is, when is it going to stop? When do we actually start changing our policies? When do we actually start using that leverage that we have? So food banks have this enormous capacity for organizing. Like I said, they serve 40 million people. They have tens of millions of donors. They reach, you know, people like myself and my family who donate cans to our kids' school food drive, to the postal food drive. You know, tens of millions of Americans, if not 100 million Americans, do that kind of thing. So there's half of the country potentially that is involved in the emergency food system in one form or another. We're not being educated. We're not being organized. Food banks are not using that leverage that they have, those connections that they have with low-income Americans, to be, you know, organizing them towards political action, towards even writing letters to their congressman about SNAP, about increasing SNAP, or to their congressman about increasing the federal minimum wage. There's this enormous potential, an enormous community organizing potential that's out there that food banks are failing to utilize. They're implementing a very top-down strategy, not asking people what they want, giving them corporate food waste because that's what's available, because the supply drives the train rather than demand. And it's enough is enough. You know, this is, you know, we're in a pandemic, people need to eat. But at the same time, if you can't get structural change out of a pandemic with the level of suffering that we've seen now, when are you going to get it? So
we're getting a number of emails from listeners saying, so what can we do about this?
It's a great question. I mean, I think people need to communicate, you know, certainly with their charities that they support, and ask them to communicate about what really drives change in this country, and conditioning their donations upon them taking on more policy advocacy, for example, or directing their donations into that arena. That's a starting point.
We have one email from Art who cites the Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign organizing around the immediate needs of people right now. Yes, Art, we actually have invited the Reverend Barber on the show, and we hope he will join us in the near future. What would you add, Raj, to all the people writing in saying, you know, the information is so needed. What can we do about this?
Well, I mean, I fully support the Reverend Barber's approach and the idea of, you know, his demand for a third Reconstruction. But that's not the sort of thing that you can just write a check for. When one asks, what can one do? I think, you know, that has to extend beyond the kinds of work that, you know, that Andy was talking about. You know, yes, we volunteer at food banks because there is this dignified emergency among the poor, but that can't be the end of things. We can't just rely on the nobility of charity, because that is precisely the character of the Band-Aid. So then if you're thinking, well, then tell me who to write a check to. I think, you know, we do need to confront ourselves with the fact that there may be a bit more work to do than that. And the work to do involves organizing. It involves being part of social movements. It involves, exchanging and building power and confronting insofar as we are, the recipients of certain kinds of class power and certain kinds of patriarchy, certain kinds of racial power and privilege, that those need to be confronted and overturned. And there are organizations that are doing that. And the Poor People's Campaign is a very good example of one of them. Looking for these transformative groups, whether it's around climate change and Sunrise, for example, or whether it's the Poor People's Campaign, there are ways not only to write a check, but to show up, and visiting their website to find out more, I think, is a great first step.
Well, I think, do we still have Darlene on the line who's been waiting patiently? Is Darlene still there? Hi, Darlene. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm curious, so how do you suggest we respond to someone when they argue that raising the minimum wage will drive small business owners out of business and ultimately hurt the workers?
Thank you for that. Raj, would you like to take that one first?
Well, I mean, and it's not just small businesses that would have to deal with that. But the fact is that if you are in a position where you're paying people less than $15 an hour in the Bay Area, then you're stealing from them. At some level, you're depending on the rest of the state to be able to make the economics of this small business work. My family runs a small business, and they used to, and this was always the subject of difficult dinner table conversation. But surely the answer has to lie in treating everyone with dignity and respect. If a business, big or small, relies on the exploitation of other human beings, or of the rest of the web of life, then it can't be okay. And if people are making margins so thin that the only way that they can think of perpetuating the business is by continuing to exploit people, then there's something wrong with the system. And raising wages is important, but we also need to be thinking about the kinds of supports for sustainable small businesses that allow people doing the right thing to thrive, because the system we've got at the moment is set up to encourage people to do the wrong thing systematically, and then as Andy was saying, rely on the band-aids of food banks and other kinds of privatized entitlement programs to pick up the pieces.
Anything to add, Andy?
Yeah, I would argue that I've seen in some municipalities, and I can't remember where, maybe as New York, in which there is a tiered minimum wage. There is a minimum wage that is higher for larger employers than smaller employers, and that's one strategy to lessen the burden on those businesses that may have struggled to pay the full amount, but to really hold accountable the larger entities that really can afford it and are just transferring wealth to their stockholders, to their shareholders.
And thank you for holding, Darlene. There's a good study out of the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UC Berkeley, and it looked at local policies in Chicago, DC, Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose, and Seattle, and they found that pay increases did not result in significant employment reductions. And so if you just search, I just searched minimum wage San Francisco study and you can find that. But thank you again for calling in.
Thank you.
I want to also just ask you both about just how difficult this is for so many people. I mean, we heard in the intro that was Shauna Gray, who said she's embarrassed about having to travel 90 minutes one way to get lunches and dinners for her family. So many people are having to seek help for the first time ever. Andy, for your book, you interviewed a number of people who go to food banks. Can you just talk a little bit about this? And we have just a couple minutes before we have to end.
Yeah, I think you're accurately portraying the level of stigma that comes with having to rely on food charity. Everybody wants to be able to stand on their own two feet, and to the extent that they can, and be able to provide for themselves and their family. And we've been relying on this, on the system that does provide, that does create the stigma. I would just argue that it's not just stigma for the recipients, but it's also, having volunteered in food pantries, I believe it's stigma and reinforces racism at the volunteer level as well. It creates this unlevel field, this unlevel playing field with very uncomfortable power dynamics, especially if you're a white person, you know, serving people of color. You know, it replicates the inherent oppression within the society. So it is problematic. And for those people who haven't grown up that way and are having to fall into this system, it's miserable.
What would you add, Raj?
I do think that, again, the indignity is part of the ideology of suffering that we're seeing from certain parts of you know, the body politic in the United States, and that it has always been part of that. The suffering has always been understood as educational when it falls on the shoulders of communities of people of color. I do think that as we go into the second dark night of the pandemic, we do need to be thinking very seriously about the kinds of political transformation that are required in order for us to stop normalizing this kind of suffering and indignity and humiliation that's part of what it is to be part of the working class in America today.
Raj Patel is a filmmaker, research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, author of Stuffed and Starved, and co-author of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things. Check out the podcast he co-hosts, The Secret Ingredient. Raj, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Andy Fisher is executive director of EcoFarm and author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Andy, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. NPR is reporting that more than 180,000 people were diagnosed with COVID just yesterday. 800,000 are applying for unemployment every single week. And Congress has not passed an economic relief package since April. As we mentioned on the show, so many vital relief measures are set to expire this month. So we will stay on this and bring you the latest in the coming weeks. And you can find articles about the issues we discussed at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. Coming up tomorrow, we are rebroadcasting our conversation with award-winning historian Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains. She explores how billionaires like the Koch brothers have shaped the U.S. judicial system. They now have a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. For decades, Republicans have suppressed the vote and gerrymandered districts to ensure minority rule. So what can be done to counter this? I hope you can join us tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.